The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. Today's featured author helps illustrate ways in which we might need to reconcile with someone or a group of someones. From the book, The Amazing Thing About the Way It Goes, Stories of Tidiness, Self-Esteem, and Other Things I Gave Up On, written by Stephanie Pearl McPhee, copyright 2014. The first story title, A Late Guy. My husband is chronically late. He's not horrifically late, but he's a little bit late for just about everything, just about every day, for any possible reason. We have a semi-annual fight about his lateness, and it always goes exactly the same way. I point out that he's late. For the sake of accuracy and winning fights, you will understand that I choose to tell him this immediately after he is late, while the lateness is both fresh and obvious. Joe then tells me that he is not late, and I am out of my mind. It just so happens that I am not out of my mind, and he is late, so I reiterate the point about his lateness. Joe again denies that he is late, and this usually propels me to my next point in the argument when I say something like, "You are always late and never on time." As an aside, I don't want to recommend my technique to anyone. It's not super effective and probably shouldn't be imported to your relationships. Saying always and never usually just triggers the other person to give you true details about the one time that they weren't late or did take out the recycling, and even if that time was 26 years ago and their dad helped them do it and it didn't go super well, it destroys your credibility. Always and never can derail a perfectly good marital spat that you're probably getting close to perfecting. I can only say those two words to Joe because he doesn't have a typical response. Instead of dwelling on the times that Joe has been on time, which he could absolutely do, he's chronically late, not a jerk. Joe dams the torpedoes and makes the same statement every time. He will insist, with great emphasis and emotion, that he is never late and always on time. It is hard for me to explain what happens next. You would think that I could describe it with great accuracy, what with the amazing number of times it's gone down exactly the same way. But there's something about rage that blocks recall. I know that I sputter a lot. I know I tell him that he doesn't get to say he's not late when he's late this much. I know that if there are witnesses, I call upon them to testify to his lateness. I also cite previous times when he was late with a great deal of detail, because the amazing thing about rage is that while it does make what happened hazy to you later on, it gives you the gift of absolute recall during the fight. I'd describe it more, but it's like every other standard-issue repeat fight that most people have in happy and long marriages. There's always one topic that comes up over and over and over again. It's usually not something big, because not being able to resolve something big can be terminal to a marriage. But there will be one topic on which the two people can't get traction, such as cups up versus cups down in the cupboard, whether or not her mother should be allowed to enter without knocking, how much ice cream kids should be allowed to eat, or whether the cat should be allowed outside. Those fights are as perennial as the grass. They are fights about a difference of opinion, and it's fair, if somewhat annoying, to argue about whose opinion is more valid, and it's bound to happen when both people are right, but disagree about that. This is not what happens in our fight. When Joe and I have the late fight, it has a name, we're not having a difference of opinion. There's a set of facts. We have a reality in which there is a set time to arrive, and Joe is not arriving at that set time. That is the technical definition of late, and he fits it. Given this truth, with Joe and a plan and a clock all in the same room, one would think that Joe wouldn't have a leg to stand on, wouldn't one? One would be wrong. Not only will Joe argue that he is not late, with the clear reality in front of him, he will do so strongly and emotionally. He'll say that he's never late, and he'll say it in a tone that tells me his feelings are really quite hurt that I would think that he was. He'll say that he is not that kind of person, that the sort of person who is late is inconsiderate. And do I really think he's inconsiderate? Is that who I think he is? Some kind of inconsiderate late person? Usually, the late fight stops right there. Joe might be chronically late, but he's not inconsiderate. Not at all. He's actually a super nice guy, beloved by all, revered by many other husbands for his prowess and skill in the field. He is kind and funny and gentle and late. The amazing thing is that he doesn't think so, and it is hard for me to stand there and hurt him by saying things about him that he really doesn't believe. Hard, but not impossible, because I am not yet perfect, and I can admit that. And I don't mind telling you that the late fight only usually stops there. Usually, I look at his face, see that he really, truly believes that he has never been late, and that he would never be late, and I am able to stop. Sometimes, though, sometimes I can't. Sometimes I am compelled by a force within me to tell Joe things that he needs to know right that minute. I remind him that his lateness was mentioned at our wedding, and it got a big laugh. I tell him that laugh was recognition. I point out that he never heard the national anthem at the kids' school because he always arrived for concerts just after it happened. I've been known to ask him if he's ever heard the national anthem because, you know, they do it first everywhere. I say, sometimes with our children nodding alongside, that I am not the only one who thinks he is late. I tell him we all think he is late, that we talk about it, that we practically have a support group, that he is so late that we are all thinking about getting T-shirts that read, "I waited for Joe." The whole time, Joe is nothing but wounded. Now, Joe is late, but he's not stupid. He can tell time, and he doesn't, typically, live in a house of lies and denial. He's a smart guy, and it took me years and years and years to figure out what's happening, how there can be universal consensus from everyone who knows him that he is absolutely, totally, without a doubt, regularly and completely late and how Joe can look us all in the eye with the honesty that is so typical of him, and tell us that he has absolutely no idea how we could ever think that. It turns out that it's all in the definition of late. And once you understand the way Joe thinks of lateness, and the exceptions to lateness that make you not late, you're there. How about this scenario? One Saturday night, I asked Joe what time he had to leave in the morning. He told me, confidently, that he must leave at 9, as he had to be in the studio by 9:30. The next morning, Joe was still drinking coffee in his jammies at 9:15. And, because I am me, I said something along the lines of, "Aren't you going to be late?" Joe, being Joe, said that he was certainly not going to be late. I'm still me, so I did something obnoxious, like remind a full-grown man that it takes 30 minutes to get to work, and that you can't go to work in your pajamas, and that, therefore, he was not only already late, but was making himself later by the minute. Joe, still being Joe, looked at the clock, realized that this was more or less true, and then said he was not going to be late, and he could tell me this because he just now changed the time that he had to be there. In his head. To my way of thinking, if you're planning on being there at 9:30, and you realize that you're not going to be there at 9:30, but more like 10, and you recognize that, then you're 30 minutes late when you arrive at 10. Enter the miraculous mind of my husband now, in which, when you realize that you're not going to be there at the set time, you just change it. No problem. Your arrival time is now 10. You are not late. You are not even the sort of person who would be. And even though you hadn't told anyone that you changed the time in your head, you're not late, and they should trust that about you. It took me some time to learn, too, that if you're standing on a corner waiting for Joe, and you've agreed to meet him at 10 o'clock, and it is now 10:20 or 10:22 when he pulls up, and if, say, you were to point out the discrepancy between the time you were expecting him and the time that it is now, presuming, of course, that this mismatch would make Joe rather technically late, then you would, very likely, be incorrect, depending on the reason for lateness. It's also taken me years to figure out that Joe is not late if the reason that he is late is not his fault. For example, if Joe leaves on time to come home, but on the way there he is caught in traffic, and this makes him arrive later than he intended, he is not late. He didn't leave late. He didn't expect the traffic. And there was no way he could be in charge of the traffic. So therefore, since he kept his part of the bargain, leaving on time, he is not late, because his intention was to arrive on time. Get it? Similarly, if we're meeting at a concert and Joe arrives outside the hall on time, but as he is parking the car, he receives a phone call and takes that call and ends up coming to his seat a full 17 minutes into the Brandenburg Concertos, he is not late. He arrived at the location at the expected time. He just didn't come in, so he wasn't late. He was there. It turns out that, to Joe's way of thinking, he is only ever late if his arrival is delayed by complete and total negligence on his part, unmoderated by the influence of others. If he intends to be on time, but makes a decision to change his arrival time when things don't look good, he's not late, because he moved the target. If he has resolved to be somewhere at a certain time, but the universe throws barriers, such as traffic, phone calls, or conversations with neighbors in his way, he can hardly be responsible for that. Lateness, as it turns out, is not a state related to the clock, or the expectations of others, or how long they might stand in the rain, desperately shielding a cardboard box with a melting ice cream cake in it. Lateness is an intention, a choice. And what kind of a jerk makes that choice? Not my Joe. He's not like that. In our next story, Stephanie Pearl McPhee describes how to balance a strong opinion with an even stronger opposing opinion. The story title, Losing the Room. I was working my way through the room, and everything was going the way it always does for me at parties. I am not the sort of person who is very good at parties. I am the person at parties who should really be in the kitchen, washing cups and making drinks and putting parsley on things. This was someone else's party, though, and I hadn't yet found my way into their kitchen to garnish anything, so instead I was wandering around the soiree with my usual strategy in force, which is to cling desperately to the person I came with, as though they were a social life raft. I stand right beside them for the whole time, no matter where they go or what they do, and when there's a lull between conversations, I mutter endearing things to them, things like, "Don't leave me." My fear has always led me to believe that this is fun for both of us. But really, it only leads to certain abandonment, as the person I've tied myself to eventually responds to this pressure by ditching me or locking themselves in the bathroom. This evening, the abandoning schlep is my husband. He has wandered off with some other engineer and will most likely surface later in the kitchen, getting drinks and putting parsley on things, but in the meantime I am wandering the party alone and trying to avoid talking to people. It isn't that I don't like people. I quite do. It's just that I like them in small doses, or in a way that's intimate, and not like this. Not at all like this. This is more like being lined up in front of machine gun fire and trying to get through it. Because I suck at small talk. To me, it feels like a barrage of wildly unpredictable questions, such as, "How are you?" or, "Are you enjoying the summer?" I believe, in my heart, that this stranger really couldn't care less, so pretty soon I start worrying that they won't be interested in my answers, or that my answers won't be very good. And then I start to get nervous, and then I start to talk, and the more I talk, the more risk I know I am taking. I don't have many superpowers. I'm really good at making very big dinners, and I can play the melody of any song I know on just about any instrument. As you would imagine, the former is way more useful than the latter, but my biggest gift is that of charm. I know it's hard to imagine someone who's as shy and nervous at parties as I am being charming, but I have worked hard to cultivate some social graces. For someone who's socially fearful, being charming makes the world an easier place to navigate, and it has been a powerful skill. I work hard at being likable. I work hard at avoiding conflict, at greasing social wheels, at generally pleasing people. And this works well everywhere I go, but especially at parties, where along with my sense of humor. It is essentially my entire defense mechanism. If this system fails, I will have nothing. The idea of being defenseless and bare in a group of people is so horrifying to me that I have been known to panic and tell random knock-knock jokes to overcome the moment. There's a concept in stand-up comedy and any sort of public speaking called losing the room. It happens when what you're saying or doing becomes uncomfortable for the other people in the room, and they stop being able to truck with what you're saying. They disengage, and you can feel it happen. There are a lot of ways to make people uncomfortable. You can challenge a belief, bring up a topic that's taboo, talk more than they would like, or, ironically, not as much as they would choose. You can accidentally violate a cultural expectation, or say something too intimate too soon. I personally specialize in bringing up a strong opinion with a particular group, only to hopelessly discover, as I feel the room begin to slip away from me, that I am explaining this view to a group of people who could not possibly be more opposed to my point of view or have a better reason to feel reviled by my choices. Allow me to illustrate. Picture me, abandoned at a party, finding myself accidentally in a knot of people who have formed around me, believing that I would not be standing by the dip if I were not really interested in a chat. We start talking. They ask me if I have any kids or pets, and I say that I have 3 grown girls who have mostly moved away, and a cat who still lives with me. Someone asks me if I have a dog, and it happens. Instead of saying just no, I start to think that I can get out of this by being charming. I'll entertain them, I think, and they won't notice that I'm really not good at this. And so I begin explaining, at great and impassioned length, that I do not have a dog, and back it up with the many robust and well-formed lifelong reasons I have for disliking dogs. I have, of course, forgotten the clear cultural quirk that only terrible people dislike dogs, and pie, which I also hate. Never tell someone you don't like pie. And that disliking dogs instantly demonstrates to people that your heart is empty of joy and kindness, and am now listing my very valid reasons. I have begun my litany with the tendency canines have to enjoy inappropriate touching, and have now moved on to the way that I hate that they don't have the willpower to save food for later. As the silence grows around me, while I expound on how I am really not into carrying around the feces of another mammal in small bags while on otherwise pleasant walks, I can feel that something has gone wrong. They're all looking at me with nothing short of violent contempt when I abruptly notice that 3 of the people I am talking to are wearing "I love my dog" buttons, and the guy to whom I am currently explaining that a dog is like choosing to have children who never grow up is right this minute wearing a t-shirt that says, "I'd probably like you if you were a dog." That, my friends, is losing the room. Whatever charm and affection you may have held sway with these people earlier, that's all gone now. Unless you've got some other talent, I would suggest singing, but have seen it go round the drain too. Your party is over. You're doomed to spend the rest of the evening walking around, trying to find a place to hide, while those people walk around telling other people how you hate dogs, and asking other guests what sort of a person hates dogs, while they glance at you like they've just recognized you as the winner from a puppy-kicking contest. Don't worry, though. They're going to leave as soon as they've told everyone, because they have to go to a dog lovers club meeting. After all, they are the executive committee. You're left at the event with your spouse locked in the bathroom, the dip clearly off limits, standing haplessly next to a framed picture of the host's golden retriever until you can get out. That room is lost. All you can do is shut up until it's over and never go back. You're not going to be able to fix it. You can't explain that you have met some very nice dogs that you were able to like on an individual basis, or that you're sure their dog doesn't do any of the things that you don't like about dogs, or even tell them that meeting them has changed you and that you're going straight to the dog rescue place to get one. It's too late. You've lost the connection, and forging it again is impossible. The room is lost, and you with it. This is what I am afraid of at parties, that my charm will fail me, and there will be nothing left, and that then the fear will overwhelm me, and my panic will guarantee the outcome. This is also what I am afraid of at speaking engagements, except there I also feel sure that someone in the room is a person who has, of their own free will and with great determination, bought a ticket or stood in line to see me, and they have known with complete confidence, since they decided to attend, that I am going to be terrible. They're only here to get the proof. I know they are there, and they're going to contribute to my personal disaster and the fear I feel. And once I'm nervous, I'll rely on my charm, and if my charm should fail, I'll panic. And this, by the way, this is how I came to be at your party, standing by the dip, talking about how your mother was probably a hooker. I was talking about crochet, and that afghan she made was really nice, and I'm sorry I bolted out your front door without explaining. I'd lost the room. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please be sure to tune in next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.